From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In the wake of the Nassar sexual abuse scandal, Michigan State University Athletic Director Mark Hollis is retiring.
Let me be clear that in retirement, I will fully cooperate with these and any other investigations.
But ESPN reports there's more to the story. MSU's president might have resigned, but Luana Simon, like a lot of university presidents, has a bunch of lifetime perks within her contract.
Their employment agreements, their benefits, have begun to look more and more like that of a corporate CEO than of a university president.
Plus, the author of a book on Michigan craft brewing says brewers want you to take your time, take in the aroma of your beer.
Not just take a beer and guzzle it down. They want them to, you know, sit there and look at it, look at the color.
And then we'll introduce you to the artisan who made that guitar. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Luana Simon is gone, but like a lot of university presidents, she has a bunch of lifetime perks within her MSU contract. Coming up later this hour, why do we give these kinds of contracts to certain public executives but not to others? But first, another day of news out of Michigan State University. Athletic Director Mark Hollis called a news conference today. He talked about the impact on the survivors and the university community because of the Larry Nassar sexual abuse scandal. And then he said he was leaving.
Today I'm announcing my retirement. This was not an easy decision for my family. And you should know, and you should not jump to any conclusions based upon our decision. Listen to the facts. I'm not running away from anything. I'm running towards something. Comfort, compassion, and understanding for the survivors in our community. Togetherness, time, and love for my family. Much attention has recently been given to the outside investigations into the university and the athletic department, including those both by the Michigan Attorney General and the NCAA. Let me be clear that in retirement, I will fully cooperate with these and any other investigations.
Shortly after that announcement, ESPN's investigative reporter, Paula Levine, was on the show Outside the Lines, explaining there's more than the Nassar scandal haunting Michigan State.
Early Wednesday morning, I sent an email to Jason Cody, the Michigan State spokesman, outlining all the information we had. It included information about accusations against football players, basketball players, information the coaches had, and specifically information that Mark Hollis had about some reports.
Levine went on to say MSU routinely violated its own policies in handling sexual harassment and sexual assault incidents involving its athletes.
Our key interview was with a former sexual assault counselor who worked directly with these women, who said that it was the practice of the university when cases were involving student athletes to basically take it away from the regular process and sweep it off into a system that was primarily handled in-house. And she even recalled a case where someone told her that Mark D'Antonio actually handled a case involving one of his players by having the player talk to his mom.
So D'Antonio is involved certainly in the reporting. Also, to the extent in June he advanced the public opinion, that incident in June, or recently in 17, was the first ever sexual assault he was dealing with. Was that accurate?
No. It wasn't, not according to her, and not according to our reporting either. We found in total 16 reported cases against football players dating back to 2007.
ESPN has released its investigative piece online. It's called Michigan State Secrets Extend Far Beyond the Larry Nassar Case. The Sports Network will be releasing more information online and on TV, including a piece on its Sunday show, E60. Well, it's been an interesting week in Michigan. Here to talk about a couple of points are our Friday political observers, Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican majority leader in the Senate. He joins us by Skype. Let's start with Governor Rick Snyder's State of the State address this week. Vicki, what got your attention among the things the governor outlined?
What got my attention was he spent the first, the majority of his State of the State talking about his legacy.
Well, that's not out of the ordinary, is it? I mean, governors do that when it's the last one.
It was an hour-long speech, and 50 minutes of it were his legacy. And he kind of skipped over the real impact of his legacy, which is the Flint crisis. I don't mind him touting his wonderful, you know, things that he thinks he's done, like fixing the tax structure, which really isn't fixed. So I have a different point of view about what he did in the last 7 years. However, I did appreciate his emphasis finally on the environment, on infrastructure, on roads and water systems, which are really important to take a look at. And I do hope that they've learned some lessons from the failed bid for Amazon, which is we are a state with their largest metropolitan area, the Detroit metropolitan area, without a viable public transportation system, which is a critical loss in the state of Michigan.
We'll take a little closer look at the infrastructure and environment thing. So, Ken, first, what struck you about the governor's State of the State speech?
I think Vicki is right about, you know, the sort of the substance of it. He spent the majority of the time kind of touting his record. But what struck me really was how passionate he was. I thought, you know, this is a governor who's not going to go down in the history books as the best speech deliverer, but I thought it was the best speech I've ever heard him give. And I think it was because he was very passionate and wanted to talk about the things he's done and his accomplishments.
Next week, the governor says he will introduce several specific proposals involving that failing infrastructure we were talking about and environmental concerns. Vicki, this legislature is preoccupied with finding a way to cut taxes. How do you think they'll receive any proposal to spend more money on roads and pollution cleanup?
They won't receive it well. They spent the balance of this week after the State of the State cutting taxes again to match some of the cuts and exceeding the cuts to match the federal income tax changes so that Michigan residents aren't critically hurt. But I want to point out that we've had a $10 billion general fund budget for the last two decades. So it's certainly not growing by leaps and bounds, and yet inflation marches on and the cost of fixing our aging infrastructure is rising dramatically. So I don't know where he's going to get the money to do the several things he talked about, to increase rural broadband access, to clean up the Michigan toxic waste sites, to increase recycling efforts, to increase the school aid fund allowance, to fight Asian carp, and to fix our infrastructure. He also wants more money for roads. I truly don't know where he's going to get it with this legislature, and I'm hoping he's successful, but I don't hold out some tremendous hope.
And, of course, more money for schools. Ken, what's the legislature going to do about these proposals?
I think we're at a kind of a time of a real policy disconnect here between the governor's belief about some of the state's needs and, as you point out, the Republican legislature's complete obsession with cutting taxes and kind of ignoring what the governor, a Republican governor, I might add, believe some of the needs are, whether it's education, roads, or environmental concerns. It's just a huge disconnect right now.
Finally, the Michigan House of Representatives has requested Michigan State University records of the Larry Nassar child sexual assault scandal and ordered its lawyers to look into whether the MSU Board of Trustees can be removed from office. Vicki, what do you think of these moves by House Speaker Tom Leonard?
I think they're a little too late. I don't mind him doing what he wants to do, but let's look at the history right here. This story, we first got the first complaints in 1997. Michigan State didn't do anything about it. That followed up quite a while later with another major complaint against Larry Nassar being brought in 2014. But it really wasn't until the Me Too movement and an Indianapolis Star investigative reporter who really brought to light the problems that were going on at Michigan State with Larry Nassar and the U.S. gymnastics team. This is much bigger than just Michigan State University. This involves the U.S. gymnastics team as well, and the coaches and their summer camp. So this is a major story. Do I think that the Michigan State trustees did not act quick enough? Yes, I do, and I think they're all culpable. I'm glad the president of the university decided to step down. Unfortunately, I don't think her statement was strong enough or welcoming enough to apologize to the victims that were hurt for the last 20 years by this man. But kudos to the judge.
Ken, what are your thoughts about the House moves, looking into records and looking into ways to get rid of some of the members of the Board of Trustees, if not all of them?
Well, everything's too late on this. I mean, but now we're looking at a House investigation, an Attorney General investigation, an NCAA investigation, and recent calls for a federal investigation coming out of the Congress and the U.S. Senate. I do want to give Speaker Leonard some credit. I think it was his move Wednesday morning to put a resolution on the House floor for all representatives to vote on calling for the resignation of the president of MSU. That was kind of one of the straws that broke the camel's back in forcing her decision. So I do want to give him some credit for that kind of aggressiveness. Now, as I think Vicki has already said and what I've said, you know, got all these investigations tripping all over themselves at this point in time, and I think we all wished at least one of them was done about 5 to 10 years ago.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator, and Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Still to come, we talked to William Rapai about his book, Brewed in Michigan. Plus, taking politics out of redistricting, lessons learned from California.
Our commission was able to focus on the task of drawing good maps as compared to trying to get any kind of political advantage.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's time to hear from another artisan of Michigan. This time we head for Old Town in Lansing. We're downstairs at Elderly Instruments. There's a lot of talent inside these walls. This time we're here to talk to Steve Olson. He's designed a resonator guitar, which can be played acoustically or plugged in.
And it does have an acoustic sound.
Resonator guitars have been around for a long time. National is the best-known brand. The resonating sound is caused by vibrations from an aluminum cone. But Olson collaborated with some of his colleagues at Elderly and came up with a unique way to amplify a resonator and use the body style of a solid-body electric guitar.
They can be kind of feedback problems live. To put a microphone on it, it's like a parabolic microphone. It just picks up everything and it's kind of squirrely. So I tried to isolate the cone inside the guitar, so I designed the guitar around it. So it's like a clamshell that protects the cone.
Sounds like something we need to hear.
It's probably the easiest, so I'll give you an example. it's a combination, trying to capture the resonator guitar sound in a solid body-ish format, I guess, or a package so that people that can play electric guitars and are comfortable with electric guitars can just pick it up and not have to really adjust to a bigger body or the acoustic sound of the resonator necessarily. I mean, they're harder to amplify.
Part of what makes it all work is what's called a biscuit bridge pickup. Whatever Olson and his colleagues have done to theirs, one report says it's caused a minor sensation in the resonator world. The guitar has a flame maple back and a polycarbonate top. Olson has a special formula he uses for finishing the top piece.
The idea originally was to replicate the finish from the 30s that National used on the metal body guitars, primarily the Duolian. It's a naphthalene-based lacquer. So when you spray it on, it crystallizes as it dries, so the patterns form naturally.
It's a distinctive look. What are your guitar players think about it? What does it say to them?
I think it evokes the feel of the original guitars, but with a, you know, it hints at it, I guess, so it captures some of that, but in a electric guitar format. I've redone vintage Nationals, and then it just kind of evolved out of that. I kind of got obsessed with it.
Guitar Player magazine reviewed the Cone Tone Resovolt a couple of years ago and concluded, if you're not a resonator player already, this thing is likely to hook you. That's Steve Olson with Cone Tone Guitars. He's our latest artisan of Michigan. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
So it's going to read from the handle here over this way. So it starts with your Sacred Cow, you've got your Farisi Stout, the Buzzsaw IPA, and then the Strawberry Blonde here.
That sounds great.
And I will be back with your flight. It's the exact same lineup.
I'm at Arbor Brewing Company in Ann Arbor, and sitting across from me in the booth is William Rapai. He's the author of a new book titled Brewed in Michigan, the New Golden Age of Brewing in the Great Beer State. How's it going?
I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
I am too. These flights look really nice. I'm going to start sipping a little bit. Let's talk about Michigan beer in general. I mean, there are a lot of states with a lot of good breweries. What makes Michigan different?
Well, for starters, it's the water. We have terrific water to work with. Second, it's the ingenuity of the Michigan brewers. These are creative people. And third, it's the passion. They want to make beer as good as they can. They wake up in the morning, they think, what am I going to do today to make a great beer? They go to bed at night thinking, what am I going to do to make that beer even better tomorrow? They have left jobs where they were working behind desks, they were doing all kinds of professional jobs, and they said, no, I would really prefer to be making beer. And they just followed their passions.
I think a lot of people who drink Michigan craft beer kind of after a while decide, you know, California's got some good stuff. Different places have some good stuff. I'm drinking Michigan beer. And that's, they just stick with it because there's such a wide variety. There's loyalty there, it seems like to me.
There's a tremendous amount of loyalty because this is what we do. It's become part of the soul of our state and part of our identity is because we make such tremendous beer.
It makes sense that you visited with Larry Bell of Bell's Brewery. He's one of the earliest brewers and one of the most successful. But tell me about Ben Edwards.
Ben Edwards was the owner of Traffic Jam and Snug, a restaurant in Detroit, just south of Wayne State University. And in the late 1980s, he decided that he wanted to be able to provide his restaurant patrons with beer. He was already making bread and dairy products, one of the really early purveyors of the farm-to-market movement. He really wanted to be able to provide the freshest possible products to his restaurant goers. So he decided that he wanted to have beer as one of the items that he could offer, but he couldn't because the way the state had set up the beer distribution, you could not be a brewer and a seller at the same time. It was an antitrust thing, and it made sense, so that way nobody could control the beer price of beer. So he sued the state of Michigan. He was unsuccessful initially, and then he got some help from a couple of Michigan state legislators, and in 1992, the state law changed that allowed brew on premises so that somebody could make beer and sell it in the same location.
This book begins with a nice lesson, an entertaining one, but still, it's a lesson on how beer is made, what goes into it, and so forth. Why do you think that was important or necessary for the book?
Beer is essentially made with four ingredients: water, yeast, hops, and barley malt. And you can take those four ingredients and make a very plain beer, or you can take those four ingredients and you can make something really, really outstanding and different and unusual just by the way you the types of barleys you use, or you add wheat, or you add some other agricultural product like asparagus or melons or cucumbers. So these things are the starting points for brewers, and a lot of brewers are simply happy making their beer with those four ingredients. But a lot of them look at beer as being something that is like an empty palate. They want to be creative. They want to express themselves, their creativity, through their beer.
I understand that they love this. They really want to do it, and they have a great time because it's art and chemistry all together. But I also know that they're using a lot of Michigan ingredients, and suddenly people are growing hops and barley that who never thought about growing those kinds of crops before.
It's just changed the face of agriculture in Michigan. People are now growing hops all over the state. As a matter of fact, a former neighbor of mine in Grosse Pointe left Grosse Pointe. He bought a farm in the Thumb where he started growing hops. He just loves making his own beer. Before too much longer, he not only was he making his own hops, he opened his own brew pub in Sandusky up in the Thumb. You drive up north to near Traverse City and you just see these huge hop farms up there, and they're making high quality hops. The wonderful thing about Michigan hops, though, is that, like grapes, if you take a grape from California and you transplant it someplace else, it picks up the flavor of the earth around it. And so Michigan hops are not only getting to the brewers fresh, but they have their own unique qualities.
Craft brewing in Michigan is basically dominated by men, but you made a point of noting some of the women brewers in Michigan. Tell me about them and the group they created, Fermenta.
So Fermenta got underway when Stacy Roth, who's now a brewer at Griffin Claw in Birmingham, got together with Pauline Lighton, who was a beer liberator, a representative, sales representative for Shorts. And they got together a few years ago, and they realized that they had a lot in common and that there were other women in the state who really could use a boost to become part of the beer scene. You got to remember, historically, brewing was women's work. While men were out doing things in the field or whatever, women were home making beer. And then all of a sudden it became men's work when the monks took over, and women were not allowed in breweries because it was thought that they had some mysterious power that would prevent beer from fermenting properly. So women were kept away from breweries for a long, long time, and it's great to see Michigan brewers like Duncan Williams down the street at Grizzly Peak, who is actively promoting women in the business.
You note that the Michigan brewers watch out for each other, and what you called it was collaboration. In what ways do they help each other? And why?
Talking to one of the brewery owners, Bill, out at Dragonmead, I said, Bill, how do brewers get together? I mean, how do they work together? He said, if I needed a bag of malt, all I had to do was pick up the phone to somebody, one of my brewers around the state, and say, I need a bag of malt. They would say, when do you need it? They work together. They collaborate to make better beer. They get together to make sure that their equipment are working properly. They share tips. They're really, really a tight group because they know that if somebody's making a bad beer or a substandard beer, that it reflects badly on all of them. I remember the first time I had a Michigan craft beer. It was many, many years ago, right after the state law was changed. And I drank it and I said, oh my goodness, this is bad. And it took me a long, long time for me to come back to drinking Michigan beer.
You feature a lot of craft brewers and breweries across the state of Michigan, but I mean, you couldn't fit them all in. So how did you decide who made it into the book and who did not?
Well, early on, I talked to the Coonan brothers, Brett and Eric out in Warren. And these guys have been around the state for a long time. They know everybody in the state. I said, who in this book should I be talking to? Who were the early pioneers? Who are the people who are really making great beers? And who are the people who are building the Michigan beer community? And they gave me a list of people, and that's really the starting point. But once I began to talk to more people, they were like, you know who you need to talk to? You need to talk to so-and-so over there. Do not miss him, because he's going to provide you with tremendous stories, really great insight about how Michigan craft beer is growing.
Yeah, I didn't even know a lot of these breweries even existed. You know, maybe I've been to a fourth of them that you listed, and that's over 15 years. You've went to a whole lot of them in 18 months. How was that?
It was fun. I had a great time, you know, because I love beer. You know, I've always been curious about beer. Even as a young person here at college and grad school in Ann Arbor, I would always seek out different kinds of beer. Unfortunately, at that time, it was pretty much a fizzy yellow beer or a lighter version of that fizzy yellow beer. It took a long time for beer tastes to change, and now that they're changing, we're beginning to mature, we're seeking out new and different kinds of beers and beer styles, and it's really tremendous to be able to have all these different things to try.
As I understand it, there's something like 300 breweries across the state. Are we at a point where we're peaking, or is there further growth to be had? Is it going to be like Starbucks, a brewery on every corner?
I hope it's not that ubiquitous, but yes, I think there's further growth to be had, simply because you can have large production breweries like Bell's and Founders and Shorts, or you can have a small brewery on a street corner that simply serves its community. Think about a place like Stormcloud in Frankfurt. It's just a small little place on Main Street, but people come from miles around just to be at Stormcloud because they make good beer, and there's a real sense of community there.
You mentioned that these brew pubs seem to be a lot more communal. It's not like a bar where you walk in, it's dark, there's some guy who's kind of ticked off at the world at the end of the bar or whatever. This is a place where people bring their families, they bring their kids in. It's very much a moment of sharing this love of Michigan ales.
And it's not just sharing the love of Michigan ale, it's just a very nice places that are very comfortable and family friendly. If you go to some place like Corner Brewery in Ypsilanti on a Saturday afternoon, you'll see wagons and tricycles and things parked outside where people go in and they have family lunch together. Over in Muskegon at Pigeon Hill, there'll be birthday parties inside the brewery. They'll order pizza, bring it in, because they don't sell food, they'll order pizza and bring it in, and there'll be a birthday party inside the brewery, and the people at the brewery are like, yeah, come on, please come join us, let's do this.
Okay, 18 months on the road, lots of breweries. What beer knocked your socks off?
Ooh, you really over at Cedar Springs Brewing Company in Cedar Springs, David Ringler spent some time playing American football in Germany. And in the off season, he worked in German breweries. And when he came back to the U.S., he got involved in the financial services industry, but he always wanted to open a brewery. So finally, he opens this brewery in Cedar Springs, and he uses his knowledge that he gained from working in German breweries, and he's just making some tremendous German-style beers there. The Hefeweizen is just terrific. The Kirster Hefeweizen is an outstanding beer. I still think my favorite beer in the state is Final Absolution from Dragonmead, because the first time that I had that, I swear, the clouds parted and angels sang. I had never had anything quite like that. We at our house, default beer in the summer is Oberon. Default beer in the winter is Two-Hearted Ale. But you'll never know what you'll find in our refrigerator.
You know, none of this would have happened if consumer taste hadn't changed in a really dramatic way and pretty quickly. What caused beer drinkers to switch from Bud Light, Coors, and Miller products to IPAs, stouts, and wheat beers?
I don't know if there was any one thing that caused them to change their tastes. I think it was just an awakening. When brewers began to open small places like this that are comfortable and they could offer their own beer, people could come in and say, hey, wait a minute, this beer is different, but it's pretty good. I like this. Eventually, people all around the state began to realize that there was an alternative to fizzy yellow beers.
William Rapai is the author of the book Brewed in Michigan, The New Golden Age of Brewing in the Great Beer State. It's put out by Wayne State University Press. Thanks for having a beer with me.
Well, thank you very much.
That would have been the end of the interview, but William Rapai had a tip you might find interesting.
So this is the Michael Pharisee Stout. One of the things I always do before I drink a beer is I will sit and smell it. I will bring it up to my nose. I'll give it away, and so, you know, I smell this wonderful biscuity, roasty smell, and that is one of the things that brewers really want drinkers to do, is to not just take a beer and guzzle it down. They want them to, you know, sit there and look at it, look at the color. I mean, think about the color spectrum that we have here, from a lighter beer to this, you know, really dark stout, and then, you know, as you pick them up, you smell them, you know, this is all piney, and you know, you've got a strawberry here. It's just fascinating to pick these up and smell them and then go on to taste them. You know, smelling them is part of the wonderful thing about drinking them.
You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A Detroit Free Press story revealed some interesting perks in the contract with the now-resigned Michigan State University president, Luana Simon. Some of them are lifetime benefits, such as free tickets for her and her husband to some sporting events, reduced prices for others, including bowl games, parking passes for life for on-campus and at all home sport and cultural events. We wanted to find out just how unusual this contract was compared to other public university presidents. James Finkelstein is a professor emeritus at George Mason University. He's reviewed more than 200 contracts of university presidents. Welcome.
Thanks, Lester.
So what strikes you as the most unusual about the contract MSU has with Luana Simon?
Well, there are a couple of things that stand out. Obviously, these lifetime perks that you've mentioned, which are not really very significant in terms of their value, but we've never seen a contract that has gone to that level of specificity to say, for instance, that a president and their spouse or partner, when the president steps down, for instance, would get lifetime courtside seats to women's volleyball games. That just doesn't happen. Usually what happens with a university president is if they stay at their university, they get an emeritus title, or if they retire, they get an emeritus title, and they get the benefits that any other emeritus faculty member would get. Usually that would include access to the library, you know, continued access to your email, maybe reduced parking fees, but no one else who steps down from their executive position or retires from a university in any of the presidential contracts we've seen have asked for those kinds of benefits.
Well, let's talk about some specifics that was pointed out in the Free Press article. If she returns to faculty, she also gets paid for a year at the presidential level, but can take a year-long leave of research at a salary of $750,000 a year. How typical is that?
We're seeing presidential sabbaticals as increasingly common in contracts. It's probably specified in about half of the contracts that we see. We think the practice is more common than that. What's unusual about this contract is that for the first year, the former president would return to the faculty. She would still be getting her full presidential salary. So she would be getting that salary for 2 years, whereas typically a president would get that for just their year of sabbatical. It wouldn't be until the third year that their salary would be reduced by some amount. In the case of Michigan State, they've chosen to have the salary be a percentage of the presidential salary, which is one of the two ways that those salaries are established. The other is to have it be pegged to the highest paid faculty member or the average of a group of highly paid faculty members in the university.
Yeah, in this case, though, she's getting paid quite a bit more than the highest paid faculty member of the university.
Yes, I looked at that, and will be making about $130,000 more than the highest paid faculty member, according to MLive.com database, an individual who's a very distinguished, internationally renowned physicist. And she'll be making well more than twice the salary of the most highly paid faculty member in the College of Education, which I assume would be where the former president would return to the faculty, because her degree is in education.
So let's back up just a little bit, a wider perspective. Why do these public sector employees get these kind of substantial and lifelong benefits? Why are university presidents so special?
Well, I think that the reason that would be given, and I'm not saying I agree with this, but if you talk to the people who help them negotiate these contracts or the search firms that identify these individuals, they say they need to provide these benefits in order to recruit the best and brightest individuals to lead these institutions. But the fact of the matter is, what we've seen over the last decade is an increasing, what I call the CEOization of university presidents. That is, their compensation, their employment agreements, their benefits have begun to look more and more like that of a corporate CEO than of a university president. The question is the one you ask. These are, in the case of our public universities, these are public executives. There are no other public executives that we hire that receive these kinds of benefits. For instance, if the Secretary of Transportation in the state of Michigan steps down from his or her position, they don't get any of these benefits. They move on to another job or they retire. The governor doesn't receive, you know, these kinds of benefits beyond their term. So it is a real question about why this one group of public executives should be treated differently than any other public executive. I can tell you, as a retired administrator and faculty member from my university, from George Mason University, I didn't receive any lifetime benefits that were of value. I got to keep my email account. I got to have access to the university library. I get a discount on parking if I decide I want to go to campus and have lunch with friends. But that's it. And that's how most university faculty are treated when they retire.
Besides what we've talked about, are there other oddities about this Michigan State contract with Luana Simon? I understand there are some things that are usually included, like really specific how you get out of the house, who's responsible for moving from the president's house, things like that. They're not in this contract?
No, they're not. And increasingly, we see those issues addressed. So when a president leaves, they can leave a university in one of five ways. They can resign. The board can terminate them without cause, that is, they just decide they want to make a change. They can be terminated for cause, that is, they have done something wrong. They can become disabled, or sadly, in some cases, they can die. The best practice in contracts that we've seen addresses each of those issues specifically and what happens under each of those scenarios. We would address moving out of the presidential house. What's the timeline? If the president has a car, what happens to the car? If the president has a country club membership, as in this case the contract allowed for, what happens to that country club membership? None of those things are addressed in the contract. I suspect those are the kinds of things that are going to be discussed with the board this afternoon in their meeting in terms of how the separation between the former president and the university is going to take place.
So just overall, give us an idea, is this contract really out of step with other presidential contracts, university presidential contracts?
Well, I think you have to take into account the fact that you have a long-serving president who has, by all public accounts, been well-liked and successful. She is among the half dozen or so most highly paid public university presidents in the country in terms of base salary. You know, her contract is among the richest that we've seen. But perhaps the reason that it isn't as sophisticated as it might be in terms of protecting the interests of the university and the citizens of Michigan is because the individual has been there for so long that her relationship with the board may well have been more a view that the board is working for her as opposed to she is working for the board. And that's always a challenge where you have a volunteer board of trustees, and the president has been in that position for a very, very long period of time. It's not uncommon for a board to defer to the president on many, many, many issues.
James Finkelstein has researched a couple of hundred university presidents' contracts. He's a professor emeritus at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thanks for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you.
If you miss any parts of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts to find the link. Gerrymandering, the drawing of a political district map to specifically give advantage to an incumbent or a political party, is an issue across the nation. It's a way of watering down the will of the voters, drawing irregular lines on a map to pack the voters you don't want into one district while leaving another district easily won by your party. In Michigan, that's resulted in a disproportionate number of Republican legislators and members of Congress. A group called Voters Not Politicians collected signatures to put a measure on this November's ballot to establish an independent commission to draw fair districts that more accurately represent voters. But how might that work? The group invited members of California's Independent Redistricting Commission to explain how it works in that state. And joining us to talk about that is Peter Yao, one of the members of the California Independent Redistricting Commission. Welcome.
My pleasure.
So this independent commission in California, strictly speaking, is not a nonpartisan commission. There are five Republicans, five Democrats, and then four members not affiliated with either of those parties. How's that working out?
Oh, exceptionally. On a personal perspective, it's a clear success. And we have voters telling us after the task is complete, after they see the election results, two out of the three respondents suggest that we have done a good job. So on that basis, I think we met the requirement of the task.
With members of the two leading parties, how well are you able to pry political advantage out of the process of redistricting?
A lot of people interpret this redistricting effort in California as a high political activity. But having done the job, having a chance to reflect on it, the decisions that we made along the way made it basically a nonpartisan activity. Let me explain that. When the proposition requires us not to take the political parameter into consideration, we as a commission decided that we're not going to look at any political data. What does that mean? We do not know the registration of the people that were doing the districts for. We do not look at the address of the incumbents. We base our decision totally based on what people tell us is what's important to them, as well as the criteria that are defined by the proposition. By following the requirement for the maps and by using the community data, that's how we drew the district. If it happened to favor Republican, it just happened by accident. If it happened to favor the Democrat, likewise, it's basically from the goal and objective, it's free of any political parameters.
So politically speaking, it's random.
Politically speaking, it's whatever the people want, okay, as long as the community is not defined politically.
In Michigan, the proposal would prohibit politically affiliated people or their family members from being on an independent redistricting committee. What do you think of taking it that far?
The California process is to screen out any people that have heavy political interests, brother-in-law working for a legislator, et cetera, et cetera. So the pool of candidates that were selected essentially is the most nonpartisan group that they can identify. And on that basis, our commission, consisting of that group, was able to focus on the task of drawing good maps as compared to trying to get any kind of political advantage.
How much did things change in California? I mean, did you see a shift for one party or the other into power?
The bottom line is, we don't care. It's that's never been an important factor. The only
yeah,
way we
I'm
find out.
I'm asking about the actual results. Maybe you didn't factor that in, but what happened in the end?
In the end, we see a lot of new participants in the elective process. One specific data that we like to use is the 8-9 years before we came into the picture, there were 765 state and congressional races between 2002 and 2011. Out of that many races, only five changed parties. After the maps were available, we look at the data between 2012 and 2017, a five-year period. We have 56 new state and congressional members. Now, I can't reference the political, as I stated earlier. We really have nothing to do with that. But just looking at the assembly seat, out of the 80 assembly districts that we have 38 assembly districts with new members.
Are there more competitive districts than there were prior to redistricting using an independent commission?
Again, competitiveness is not a parameter that we worked with, but the data, according to Politico magazine, is that California went from run-of-the-mill toward the second half of the distribution to the most competitive state in the whole country. So I think on that basis, we can say that, yes, indirectly, we create a lot more competitive districts.
As you went through the process, were there any unintended consequences?
Unintended consequences. From a political picture, absolutely. For example, we put two highly ranked Democratic congressperson in the same district, and they end up having to run against each other to win a single seat, and one of the two would lose. And we have state districts where the incumbent end up selling his house, buying a house two blocks away to be in the district that he preferred to run in as compared to the previous district that he had all by himself. So these are the type of things that happen after. We also see a lot of new minority candidates entering the race.
What would you advise Michigan voters to consider before they vote on this proposal in November?
Appeal to the people that this is good government. This enables the voters to define their district and help identify what type of representative they really want to represent them in the area that are most important to them, whether it's economic, whether it's in California's case, you know, the grape grower district or any other community of interest that they have. It's really what is important to them, and wouldn't it be nice if they can have a representative that would represent their interests.
Peter Yao is a member of the California Independent Redistricting Commission. He is a Republican. He's joined on his visit to Michigan by a Democrat and an independent from the commission. They'll be meeting, or are meeting, with media around the state and holding town hall meetings. That's all coordinated by voters, not politicians. Thanks very much for taking a moment to talk to us.
My pleasure indeed.
2 weeks after her husband Jorge was deported to Mexico, Cindy Garcia will be at the Capitol when President Trump delivers his State of the Union speech.
I want him to realize that I am a person, I am an American citizen, and so are my children, and he's tearing us apart.
But she says she's staying strong.
I said, we all have to be there for each other, and I tell my husband also, do not get depressed, do not get down and out. We are still continuing the fight. We will bring you back. It's just the time. Just give us time.
That story and more next week
on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, whom you can blame for any flaws in the show, or, you know, whatever you want to blame him for. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joy Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.